Welcome to the European Journal of Plastic Surgery Journal Club. Together with Plaster and Icoplast, we bring you the latest open access articles with unique insights from the authors and discussion with plastic surgery experts around the world. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy this month's episode. Hello everyone, and thank you for joining us for this month's episode of the European Journal of Plastic Surgery Journal Club. I'm your host, Demetrios Rhesus, and I'm a plastic surgery registrar in London, UK, and head of operations for our trainees association called Plaster. Today, we'll be discussing and appraising a new open access article published in EJPS entitled Suspected Breast Implant Rupture, Our Experience, Recommendations on Its Management, and a Proposal for a Model of Informed Consent. It is written by first author Dr. Nicola Zingaretti and senior author Professor Pierre Camillo Parodi. And we're honored to be joined by both of them today to discuss their article. Dr. Zingaretti is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon working at the Santa Maria della Misericordia Hospital in Udine, Italy. He is also completing his PhD at the University of Verona, and we're very honored to have him joining us today. Thank you very much, Nicola.
I thank you for your kind invitation to talk about this topic.
Professor Parodi is the Chief of Plastic Surgery in the Department of Plastic, Reconstructive and Aesthetic Surgery in the Santa Maria della Misericordia Hospital in Udine. He is an Associate Professor also in the Department of Experimental and Clinical Medical Sciences at the University of Udine and has published extensively on topics ranging from breast reconstruction and microsurgery to the clinical applications of stem cells in plastic surgery. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Parodi.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you and a great opportunity. Thank you very much.
And we're also honored to be joined by Dr. Philip Stillett. He's our independent expert today. He is also a plastic and reconstructive surgeon working at the University Hospital in Ghent in Belgium, where he has a wide scope of practice in both breast reconstruction and body contouring. And he has a particular interest in regenerative medicine and lipofilling, having carried out a lot of research in the field of fat and tissue transplantation. Thank you also for joining us, Dr. Stillett.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here tonight with you.
And as always from EJPS, we're honored to be joined by the editor-in-chief, Dr. Horatio Mayer. He is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon and deputy head of the plastic surgery service at the Hospital University Hospital Italiano de Buenos Aires in Argentina. He's also the chairman of the education committee of Icoplast, and he is a driving force that makes this journal club possible. Thank you again, Horatio.
Thank you, Demi, for your kind introduction and for your huge efforts in making this wonderful journal club possible.
And last but not least, we're joined by Dr. Alfonso Navia-Torelli. He is a plastic surgery resident in the Department of Plastic Surgery in the Pontifical Catholic University of Chile in Santiago. He has already published a range of interesting articles focused on plastic surgery training, and in particular recently in the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. He has kindly agreed to summarize and appraise the article for us today, and we look forward to hearing from him now. Thank you very much, Alfonso.
Thank you, Demi and Dr. Mayer, for your invitation. I'm going to do the general commentary and critical appraisal of this edition's Journal Club article, already mentioned by Demi. As an introduction, we know that breast augmentation with silicone implants is one of the most common procedures in plastic surgery. Implant rupture is an important complication and the most common cause of implant removal. However, less than 50% of ruptures are suspected or detected by physical examination, making imaging diagnosis like with ultrasound or MRI a frequent consultation and a diagnostic challenge for radiologists. We have two types of ruptures, extracapsular, when both the implant shell and capsule are breached with macroscopic leakage of silicone, and intracapsular rupture, when the implant shell is breached without macroscopic leakage beyond the capsule. And although there are some signs both at the US and MRI, there is not a high match with the clinical picture, and there are absence of guidelines that often entail sending patients for revision surgery rather than carrying out in-depth radiodiagnostic to confirm implant rupture. So the objective of the authors in this article was to report their multicentric experience, establish a diagnostic therapeutic algorithm, and propose a model for informed consent. So they did a multicentric retrospective analysis during 6 years from 2002 and 2018 in three different centers of Italy. They gathered 183 records of women submitted to prosthetic revision surgery due to radiological diagnosis of suspected implant rupture, both for aesthetic and reconstructive reasons. They give the detailed demographics, their medical history, physical exam, and some surgical and implant specifications. They classified in three different categories respect the results of the US or MRI in normal, suspected rupture, and a frank rupture. And in those cases, they divided in intracapsular, extracapsular, or the mix of both. They had a total of 221 explanted implants in those 183 women, and they examined and classified them as rupture or intact. Overall, about the results, the mean duration of implants were about 14 years. The mean implant volume was about 330 cc's. 57% of cases were of reconstructive matters, and 60% of the implants were in a retromuscular plane. The most frequent reasons for radiological examination were as a matter of control or follow-up in 56% of patients, which were, of course, asymptomatic. However, 25% consulted because of deformity or redness, 15% because of pain, and 4% because of recent trauma. What is really curious and good about this article is that when they were sent back to the plastic surgeon after the imaging diagnosis, 36% of the patients were asymptomatic, but 31% reported deformation or redness, and the pain went up from 15% to 33%. As a matter of the analysis, 51% of the studies of the implant ruptures were studied with ultrasound alone, 26% with MRI alone, and 23% with a combination of the both methods. Of the 221 explanted implants, 148 implants were effectively ruptured. However, 33% of them were intact, being unjustifiably explanted. Most of these implants were evaluated by US alone, 42%, or MRI alone, 31%, and only 15% of the implants studied with US and MRI were in fact intact at the moment of the explant. The authors declared that none of the demographics were correlated with the implant rupture. They also proposed an informed consent based on evidence-based medicines, the authors' experience, and also available literature. And they divide the informed consent in three parts. First, the first part where they explain both pros and cons of watchful waiting attitude. A second part where they explain the possible psychological consequences of the different conducts. And the third part where they describe in detail the different prosthetic revision surgery. So this is the algorithm presented by the authors. Overall, we have that patients that were either asymptomatic or that had mild symptoms like pain or discomfort were first studied by ultrasound in comparison to those patients that had either deformation, asymmetry, redness, or swelling, or recent trauma that were first studied by MRI. Then, depending on the findings, they usually combine both methods of studies because those patients that had ultrasound and MRI together positive, they were suggested to go to breast implant revision surgery. However, those with negative findings or doubt in the results, they talked to the patients based on the informed consent that was mentioned previously, and then they decided with the patient if they wanted to continue with watchful waiting or do a more aggressive approach. And what they propose that is really interesting is that they suggest doing a psychological evaluation of these patients. So as a matter of conclusions, this is the largest case study of suspected implant rupture. This study comes to confirm that the association of ultrasound and MRI represents the mode of diagnosis with fewest false positives, as well as how the psychological picture of the patient can influence the surgeon's decision. And given the high number of errors associated with suspected intracapsular rupture, it is necessary to submit a specific informed consent that clearly explains patients the possible alternatives and takes into account the emotional component, as well as evaluate the need of psychological counseling. That would be it.
Thank you very much, Alfonso. That was a great summary. It really is a fascinating paper to see how many implants that are perceived to be ruptured prior to surgery are in fact not in up to a third. So it's great to see and great summary there. I'll just ask you a few questions now before we move on to the discussion with Horatio and the authors and Dr. Stillert as well. So Alfonso, just to get a bit of a grasp of the study in a bit more detail, you've touched on this already, but do you think that the study addresses a clearly focused issue?
Yes. I think they focus the issue really clearly. The aim was really clear since the beginning of the paper, which is very well written. And they report the experience of the multicentric experience. They present this algorithm as well as the informed consent. So yes.
Lovely, thank you. And do you think that they recruited or selected the cohort of patients in an acceptable way?
Yes, I think they addressed the different biases that are within the retrospective studies. However, in this topic, I think that a retrospective study is a good methodology. They don't give too much detail on how was the method of gathering the information or reviewing the records, but I think that the data gathering was adequate.
Perhaps, Nicola, would you like to give us a little bit of information there on the process by which you gathered the data retrospectively?
Yes, I appreciate the good introduction and the presentation of the article. Thank you so much. One of the limitations of this study is the retrospective approach. We are currently enrolling patients for a multicentric prospective study to validate our protocol and to reduce the number of false positives. It's too early to talk about results, but however, our preliminary results are very encouraging. The idea of this paper was born after the crescent numbers of patients without impra-rupture after a revision surgery for radiological diagnosis of a suspect implant rupture. So we talk about this topic with other colleagues and explain them our number of implant without rupture at explantation. So we understood a lot of a center in our country have had the same problem. So we conducted the larger case study of this topic, but we hope to find more information in the future that confirm our results.
If I can, the idea was born in mountain because we were with friends skiing or plastic surgeons, and we were surprised of the number of false positive there because we are from the north part of Italy in a very sophisticated diagnostic centers for radiology. I mean, Milan, Bologna, and Northeast. And this is very important because it means that the problem is really clear, really important.
Absolutely. Just to follow up on that, I might ask Alfonso as well. Do you feel that the results from this study can be applied to the rest of the population, both perhaps locally, but also in the population you have in Chile and in elsewhere internationally?
Well, I think this in retrospective studies like this with a specific population, there's always some concerns about internal and external validity. I think that we have to appreciate that this is the largest case study. So I think, and they propose a really interesting informed consent as well as the algorithm. So I think they do bring knowledge to this topic. So yes, I think it's a really good first step. And probably some of the minor things would be addressed with that second stage of the study that Dr. Singariti is expressing. Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. And I agree. The algorithm you proposed is very practical, I think, and very easy to follow. So hopefully that's something that can be tested both through your own study and perhaps even other institutions as well going forwards. Thank you very much, Alfonso, for those comments. I'll hand over to Horatio now to ask a few questions of the authors and also Dr. Stylet.
Thank you, Dimi. First of all, I would like to thank to Professor Parodi and to Dr. Singariti for choosing the European Journal as an outlet of their work. This is a very well-written article. It has limitations, for instance, its retrospective nature, but on the other hand, it has the value of being a multicentric study. I would like to ask a few questions about the data that you gathered with this study. Were you able to notice any specific brand between this retrospective study, any specific brand that were more commonly ruptured if compared to others?
Yeah, I wrote in the article, in the paper, I wrote a table where you can find a lot of brand of implant that we remove, and we didn't see any different statistical differences between brands. But in this part of Italy, a lot of plastic surgeon put in the past a lot of Megan. So our patients, we remove above all a lot of Megan.
And perhaps a philosophical question: did you explore which is the behavior of a plastic surgeon in Italy when facing a case replacing a suspected rupture implant? Would you leave the same implant in place, depending perhaps on how old is the implant, or would you just remove it, or would you just replace it for a brand new implant?
If we take away the prosthesis from the pocket, we have to change the implant. The rule in Italy. This is done also if the breast, the prosthesis was done 3 months ago or 6 months ago. Because if you take away outside the pocket, we have to change the implant. I don't know in your country, but this is the official.
So it's mandatory to, once you open the pocket, to replace it.
When you take away the prosthesis from the pocket, if you open the pocket, you leave the pocket inside, there is no necessity for the law to change the prosthesis.
And even for reconstructive cases, if you need to do some revision, you need to change always the implant.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other question is, do you have knowledge of any legal claim for a patient facing, you know, a surgery that actually was not necessary, and the main reason for indicating the surgery was a false positive in MRI or an ultrasound study?
Our study was designed just for, because one of the participants explained this kind of situation. So there was a claim, and the lady asked for money because they say that the operation was not necessary, so I don't want to pay for that.
Okay. So what a typical, I mean, of course, every surgeon is different, but sometimes many cases, you know, also when we are dealing with patient operated by other colleagues, you know, and we found something unexpected during a surgery, which is the philosophy of the plastic surgeon. Is gonna describe in the clinical record what actually he really found, or he's gonna be, I mean, sympathetic with the colleague and say, okay, I'm not gonna write that the implant was intact, or are gonna write the true. In the case that this surgeon, as you say, the surgeon write the right thing in the clinical record of the patient, knowing that this could originate a claim from the patient to your hospital. Also, this is a matter of ethics, of course, but you know, if, I mean, in any opportunity, this organ was hidden to the patient, for instance?
Well, I think that from our article, our paper, from our experience confirmed that the psychological discomfort of the patient may influence the surgeon's choice or decision about the diagnostic and therapeutic procedure to be undertaken. So it must to be taken into account that near 50% of women report symptoms during follow-up or surgical visit after a radiological diagnosis. So as Holmick report in the literature, the prosthesis stay inside. If you have a suspected breast implant rupture, you can leave the prosthesis inside for 2 years without general problem for the patient. So I think that it's important for us to wait. If the patient is asymptomatic, it's important to wait to do a revision surgery.
If I can answer about the ethical question that you did, The situation is quite different in reconstructive and in aesthetic. In aesthetic, yes. It's a trouble because you pay money for the operation and you pay again for something that probably is unnecessary. The center of the trouble is to be very clear with the patient before to perform operation. You have to say, my result and my experience is that there is the possibility that the 30% of the suspected implants are not destroyed, are not so necessary to operate. So probably the choice is to have a good information, a good feeling with the patient, but sharing reconstructive and aesthetic.
Thank you.
I personally write everything I found in aesthetic and reconstruction.
Perfect. Philippe, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question because it's not our policy to see the patients every year for an ultrasound. Is that the general policy at your department?
No, it depends. In reconstructive surgery, the patients is followed every year with ultrasound in the contralateral breast, of course, and ermine if there is any kind of symptomatology. In aesthetic, before the crisis of the prosthesis, personally, unfortunately, I see 1% of my aesthetic breast augmentation after 5 or 6 years because they don't go to the consultation. So we suggest just clinical examination.
Yes. Yeah.
If there is any suspect, any symptomatology, we have to ask for ultrasound or MRI, but usually it is just a clinical examination in aesthetic.
Okay. And could you explain me a bit more about that somatoform disorder? So these are asymptomatic patients. They come for a follow-up. They get an ultrasound. How do you explain that?
Well,
so these are patients that become symptomatic.
Yeah, I also told about a psychologist of this topic. I think that the diagnosis of a suspect rupture in asymptomatic patients may cause the patient to experience anxiety and to complain of vague symptoms. This may in turn persuade the surgeon perform revision surgery, even if the symptoms do not necessarily warrant such a course of action. So, we found a lot of patients, as Alfonso showed us, that we found a lot of patients who came in our outpatient clinic for follow-up visits, so asymptomatics, and then after the diagnosis with US came back with a lot of symptoms. So it's very strange.
Another reason is that, especially for aesthetic, we have a very strong program for showing a cancer, and the population is called by the regional system at 45, 50 years old. So there is a lot of all the breast augmentation that we discovered or there is a diagnosis of rupture asymptomatic because of the program for the cancer. So they don't go to the plastic surgeons for the breast rupture, but the prosthetic rupture, but they come for breast cancer detection.
Okay. And did you see any correlation with the capsule regarding rupture? Capsular contraction rates in the rupture implants and the non-rupture implants?
Well, for example, we found a lot of double capsule with the use of macrotexture implants, for example, Megan, but no capsular contracture.
No correlation.
Your study included something like 12 years period, right?
Yeah.
How many patients in those centers actually underwent during that period breast reconstruction or breast augmentation surgeries? I mean, did you calculate the exact incidence of real rupture, implant rupture in your population?
No, I really don't think that this information could be done by this particular kind of study. It's very important to have a national register for the prosthesis. Probably this is the way for starting to having a real idea of the percentage of rupture in our patients, because there are a lot of bias in our institution, because many patients are coming from the south, or we lose patients and so on. National registration is probably the way for having a better results and no bias. Unfortunately, we had to start 2 years ago, 1 year ago, in Friuli, my region. We started for 3 months, but the COVID crisis was very bad also for that experience. So at the moment, the Italian register is not available.
My question actually was, perhaps many implant companies, they use as a advertising strategy. They say that they offer lifetime warranty for their products. So the question is, do we actually believe that a breast implant can last forever in a patient, a lifetime for a patient? Or actually, because we jump from just companies offering 10 years warranty, and in those implants that were removed, they were 14 years old. So it's near, you know, that used to be the classic warranty that was 10 years. So what I'm trying to say is do you actually believe that a breast implant can last a lifetime in a patient, or is just an advertising or marketing strategy from breast implant companies?
Again, information is very important. When you have a patient for breast reconstruction or also for aesthetic surgery, you have to explain that your surgery is not for life. Probably you have one or two possibilities to change the prosthesis or to modify the soft tissue above the prosthesis. Also in reconstruction, this is very important to explain to the patient that autologous reconstruction is definitely better than prosthetic reconstruction. And if you perform a prosthetic reconstruction, you need to make a revision. In our experience, 30% of the patients have a revision after 5-6 years. So it's a lot. You must be very clear with the patient. I really don't believe that the warranty of the companies are very important, because they cover only the cost of the prosthesis, and it is very difficult to have that money if you are not a surgeon with a lot of breast implants.
Yes.
This is the reality. So it is probably the 20% of the cost of the operation. And the ladies must pay again the 80% of the cost of the operation.
Of course. And what about you, Philippe? What do you think about this, about lifetime warranty for breast implants?
Well, honestly, it's always a bit biased. It's difficult. There's so many factors involved in rupturing implants. So I don't really believe in it. So, you know, there's so many things involved, lifestyle, the recipient side, you know, it's difficult to, I'm not telling my patients that they get a lifetime warranty. I say, I'm still telling them that it will be at least 10 or 15 years, but not a lifetime warranty. I don't think you should say that to your patient, because you're still inserting a foreign material, you know, and the induction of capsula or scar formation is very unpredictable. I had implants that I removed and there was almost no capsule, but then the other implants had a very thick calcified capsule. It's so individual. But you know, I think the basis is that you still have to consider it as a foreign material, but with an impact on your surrounding tissues.
Absolutely.
Lovely. Thank you, Horatio. We've just had a few questions in, and we've just touched on it a little bit there. With regards to, we talk about in your paper, the informed consent process for a patient in this situation who already has implants. But I think Prof. Parodi was just saying the consent discussion, even prior to insertion of implants in the first place, has to include the possibility of further surgery, of course. But based on the results of this study, have you had any developments or changes that you've implemented in that discussion right at the start of the process for patients with regards to their risk of further surgery and how this would be approached if they were to have symptoms or find something on a scan, perhaps. When you're thinking of counseling a patient for insertion of implants in the first instance, do you think it's important to say to them that if you develop any symptoms or if something is noticed on a scan when you have the implants in place, we will address it in a number of ways, either further surgery or monitoring? Is this something you mentioned at the very start of the process now that you've carried out this research?
Yeah, asymptomatic and symptomatic patients are two different groups. We were very worried about the symptomatic patient. We have to heard about the patient to be very conscious and very precise in this kind of a category. So probably we must spend more time in symptomatic patients. Of course, there is a psychological reaction if there is an answer from the radiologist that there is a breast rupture, because they come, okay, it's rupture, you have to change. And you have to explain again to the patient that we must discuss, there are troubles, there are possibility to wait to see after 1 year if there is really the necessity for changement, for the changement of the prosthesis. Asymptomatic patients are another question. Probably we have more time and it is much easier to choose the right way to do for the patient.
Thank you very much. I think there's just one other question here with regards to your algorithm. And you've just touched on it again, Prof. Parodi, in that algorithm where they've had an ultrasound and MRI, and it is a maybe as to whether they have a rupture or not, but the patient is symptomatic. You then give the patient the choice following discussion and evidence-based medicine with regards to whether they continue monitoring or have the surgery. And in your experience, what have you found with patients in that situation? Are they more happy to keep monitoring, or are they more keen to have surgery if they're still symptomatic?
If I have a patient with the prosthesis 12 or 14 years old, and in Italy 10 years ago the rule was that you have to change the prosthesis after 10 years, so the patient is prepared to the operation, so you have to discuss with her with which is the best strategy. Algorithm, it doesn't mean that you have to do that. You have to discuss to choose with the patient which is the right way. This is my opinion also in asymptomatic and symptomatic patients.
Lovely, thank you so much. And Dr. Stillett, did you have any other thoughts on the paper? Have you had any experience of treating patients with suspected implant rupture where the implant turned out to not be ruptured, perhaps, as in 33% of the cases in this paper?
First of all, we're not doing ultrasound on a regular basis. We see them clinically. I advise my breast augmentation patients to come and see me once a year. Often they do not come anymore. But what we see is when a patient has complaints or any problems or discomfort or swelling, the first thing we do is an ultrasound. And then if they see something positive on that ultrasound, then we perform an MRI. And in most of the cases, MRIs are very efficient. It's more than 90%. And that's a bit our policy.
I have a question for Philip. You published a very beautiful paper on composite breast reconstruction. We perform also a lot of composite breast reconstruction. Do you think that has improved the number of rupture because of approach?
Yeah, but
my feeling, it is not a scientific point of view. My feeling it is that the number has increased.
Well, honestly, I had one rupture, but that was because of an instrument, because they did an electro microscope examination on the implant and it saw like a sharp cut on the implant. That was the only one. But the purpose of the composite breast reconstruction is actually to lower the amount of foreign material. And that's what I explained to my patients. You know, honestly, we don't like implants. It's a foreign material. And I also see a lot of patients complaining with the general disease, like arthritis or general complaints, fatigue. And I do think that it is related to certain implants. But the purpose of the composite one is to include as much as autologous tissue as possible. I think that an implant should not dictate the aesthetic or reconstructive outcome of a breast. It should be the tissues that are surrounding the implant that should dictate the aesthetic outcome. And I think that's very important. And that's something I explain to my patients also. I mean, the purpose of this kind of this type of operation is to lower the amount of foreign material.
Yeah, I totally agree. But in average, our patients received two or three liposructure as a normal part of the procedure. And that it means that especially if there is an expander or a very thin skin, it is not so impossible to have a rupture due to the
cannula
injection. So probably in this particular kind of patient, we must be very careful about the follow-up. This is my opinion.
Yeah, that's true. But in general, with a blunt cannula of like 2 or 3 millimeters, it's quite easy to expand that the space between the skin and the capsule. Even if you don't introduce the cannula completely, but if you inject the fat, you see the fat, like the fat is spreading. Yeah? And honestly, what I do now, I massage the skin on the flop to spread the fat. It works well, because today also I had a case and I did like an, if you have the opportunity, you should take like a little endoscope and go in between the skin and the capsule. And you will see that space is a very compliant and stretchable space. And there's no need to aggressively introduce that cannula. If you just introduce a little bit and you inject your fat will spread in between that space. But I didn't have any trauma to the implants after the lipofilling sessions. Because what I do at the end of every reconstruction, when the patients are completely finished, I do I always do an MRI study afterwards.
At the end of the procedure?
Yes, at the end. So like, for example, 6 months after the insertion of the implant.
Just I would like to do a comment about that. I were critic before about the breast company, you know, offering perhaps the impossible promise of a lifetime warranty. But on the other hand, I think it's fair to comment that there is a company that is working. Philippe knows about that. You know, it's a brand company that is Motiva Implants. They have a transponder that currently this transponder, you can know the serial number of the implant, but they are working in making this transponder able to offer important information to recognize a true rupture of the implant. For instance, they are working in creating a transponder that is going to be able to detect changes in the pH of the tissue that is in contact with the silicone gel, or changes in the pressure of the implant. That, of course, occurs when the implant is ruptured. So I think that is fair enough to mention also that companies that are not only offering false promises of lifetime warranties, but also they are working to offering solutions, you know, to this problem that is operating a patient with a diagnosis of rupture implant that wasn't rupture.
Very important, because it is the real way for solving the problem. To have a better material with a good control of the integrity of the envelope. But unfortunately, we are quite far from the solution, and also the pressure is not the solution because of the capsular contracture. So probably also in this situation, we will have a false positive or negative. And the combination of the system is the way for having a less number of complications.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The point, the idea is reducing the number of false positives.
Any last comments?
No, I just want to congratulate the authors with the manuscript. It was really nice to read, and it's very informative. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Really nice article.
Lovely. Thank you so much. That was a great discussion of an amazing article, I agree. And the article is available to download and to read as well on EJPS. So everyone listening, please have a read and continue to think about these topics for your own practice as well. What I think we'll do now, just before we close the Journal Club, is if I ask from our panel, just for some advice for the trainees listening, for your training going forward, essentially. So I'll ask Nicola Zingaretti first. What would be your advice for trainees coming through plastic surgery training and how to balance carrying out high quality research alongside their clinical work?
I'm still young, so I don't believe that I'm in a position to give advices. However, my mentor every time advised me to be curious. At the end, every curious person find science really interesting and would like to be the first person to discover something new or understand a previously unknown process or mechanism. I encourage residents to start by learning more about what interests them and connecting with other researchers or professors. From my experience, firstly, I select a topic of my personal interest and learn more about it. The research for and the writing of a paper will be more enjoyable if you are writing about something that you find interesting. Select a topic which you can find a manageable amount of information. Do a preliminary search of information searches to determine whether existing searches will meet your needs. And try to be original.
Lovely. Thank you so much. That's great advice. I think that's really important. And yeah, I completely agree with all that. Thank you. Prof. Parodi, I think it'd be interesting to ask you the same question from your perspective, having seen so many trainees and residents coming through the programs. What do you recognize in a trainee who's able to deliver both clinically, but also with good research output and good thinking as well?
Yeah, we are performing the best job in the world, because every a few years there is a total changement of the ideas and the informations. But also we are artisans, so it's very important to have a technical program. And I'm very worried about this time, because in our country for 1 year the formation of the young surgeon has stopped. Completely, only cancer and no aesthetic, no other no malformations. So it's a very hard time for the formation of the young population. So probably we have to force the situation in the future to try to have a better program.
Thank you very much. Yes, that's very important. And yeah, we really appreciate that as well. Dr. Stillett, just building on from that, it'd be great to hear your thoughts and encouragement for junior plastic surgeons as well. You've obviously developed new techniques and new ideas during your career, and how do you encourage junior plastic surgeons to think along the same lines and be as innovative and curious as Nicola said as well?
It's all a matter of opportunities, you know. I did general surgery training and I had the opportunity to go to Australia for a fellowship in microsurgery and tissue engineering, and they should grab all the opportunities they can take, you know. And that fellowship actually directed my career, and it makes you curious. It opens your mind also, because you meet other people, you make connections, and I think it's very important to broaden your view outside your department where you're being trained. I think that's very important. And secondly, I think it's very important to stay a doctor, you know, and not becoming a commercial center or whatever, because it's very, I see very, younger generation is a bit sometimes driven too much by money making, honestly. And I feel that, I mean, it's very dangerous not to become a doctor anymore, I had the impression. And what I also think it's very important is not to focus on quantity, but on quality. And think if you operate two patients and they're really well operated, they will bring you in more patients. But if you operate four patients, because you have a busy schedule and they are really badly operated on, this is not a good publicity. But I think the main message is that please stay a doctor. Yeah? You're still treating patients. That's very important. And meet people, go to conferences, and also stay fascinated by the human body, because you have the advantage or the privilege to work from head to toe, you know. This is one of the only disciplines, and also like Professor Parodi says, you are actually an artist, an artisan. And that's very nice about our job.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for those words. We really appreciate it. And some great inspiration there, both from your own examples and from your kind words there from all of you. So thank you so much. I think with that, we'll end today's Journal Club. It's been a fantastic discussion of this really great paper, and a lot for us to take back to our own practice, and to think about further ways that we can investigate this important issue as well. So with that, we'll end the Journal Club. And I'd just like to say thank you very much to our panel. Firstly, to Dr. Alfonso Naviatorelli for your great summary and appraisal of the paper. Thank you, Alfonso.
Thank you for the invitation.
And thank you, as always, to Dr. Horatio Meyer, who's the editor-in-chief of VJPS and really selects the articles and drives on the publication of high-quality research, and also brings us this Journal Club, which is great.
Thank you, Dimi, for making this possible.
And thank you as well, Dr. Philip Stillett, for your great comments and insights in the paper today.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you also to Dr. Nicola Zingaretti for all your hard work to put the paper together, and writing it and researching it so well. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much to you. Stay healthy.
And thank you as well to Professor Pierre Camillo Parodi. You're driving great work in your unit, as we can see. And it's really an inspiration to all of us to keep working hard, and especially through this time, as you say. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Happy Merry Christmas to you, to your family in this very difficult time. Ciao.
Thank you. Ciao, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this month's European Journal of Plastic Surgery Journal Club. Please send us your thoughts about the article on social media using the hashtag EJPS Journal Club. Thank you again, and see you in 2 months for our next episode.